Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The best things happen after dark. Nightclubs are the ultimate space for self-expression, escape, music, socializing, and forgetting for a moment the outside world. They're a place to discover ourselves, find new friends, and fall in love. As humans, we like to dance to a beat, and there's nothing like a good night out. I'm Jody Harsh. I'm a DJ, producer, and occasional club promoter. I know how to tear up a dance floor, and for this podcast, I want to explore with my guests how club culture and going out has shaped their identities and informed their work. I've got us the guest list and cue jump sorted, so we'll delve right into the hazy memory banks and hit the floor. This is Life of the Party. It's difficult to imagine the UK's clubbing landscape without today's guest. He's a London-based DJ, producer, remixer, club promoter, and founder of Fantasy Sound, the record label. He's rubbed shoulders with the Armands and the Armins on the top of the DJ of the Year lists, but always stayed true to his core beliefs and tastes. His club Trash became one of the most influential clubs of its time. Errol Alkin, this is your Life of the Party.
Thank you. Thank you for the intro.
First of all, I want to start at the very beginning, your first ever party as a child. Do you remember a birthday party growing up or something?
Oh, God. First party I can remember.
Or was there like a big Christmas party?
You know, I mean, weddings were the big thing when I was growing up, being like Turkish Cypriot. There's a lot of weddings. Maybe to a month it felt like, you know. So it was really, really, really from a young age I remember being around a lot of big Turkish weddings, which would always involve bands playing traditional music, belly dancers, lots of children drinking skull lager, and adults smoking and drinking. So
So not much has changed
now.
Nothing
has changed much at all. No, it was really, just thinking back on it. I mean, there was a lot of, I suppose, the kind of social circle that would have kept back then would have been fundamentally like, yeah, weddings and stuff, you know, that. And I didn't really know of any other kind of parties as such growing up.
And then you started DJing as a teenager, right? Pretty young.
Yeah, I was still only maybe 16.
Okay, so a bit of sneaking out, were you allowed?
Yeah, no, sneaking out. I mean, I used to go to, when I was still at school, I used to go around to my friend's house, Lee's house, and he had two decks. Like, he was one of the only kids in school who had two decks and a mixer. We used to listen to pirate radio all the time, so I used to go around there and I used to take some of the records that I had to school and then go to his house after, and we'd just kind of learn how to mix records together, you know, and record it on tape, and then eventually I had the opportunity to go to nightclubs myself, and part of it, I suppose it's just in my kind of like in my psyche, you know, as well as enjoying the music, I kind of wanted it to be something different in a way, you know. I kind of wanted what I really loved to be playing, because I enjoyed that environment so much. You know, I really found clubs to be somewhere where I apart from home, was the first sense of something that was a similar kind of feeling of like belonging, you know, in that environment. I was all of a sudden you're kind of around other people, like similar people, you know. It was kind of like something that I probably didn't get when I was at school. It wasn't until nightclubs, and it suddenly like felt
finding your tribe, kind of.
Yeah, 100 100% that, yeah.
Do you remember walking into a club for the first time and how that felt? And do you remember which club that was?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was the Dome in Tufnell Park. I just remember just like when you're younger, like kind of certain spaces just feel bigger and more cavernous than when you get older. And it's like when you go back home to your old bedroom and stuff, and it used to be feel really big, and then you walk into it, it's tiny.
It's a box room, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I remember kind of walking into a nightclub and just it feeling just gigantic. Absolutely gigantic. It felt like walking into a stadium, and it wasn't. Like the Boston Arms is not, or the Dome, which is above the Boston Arms in Tufnell Park, is by no means like a huge room or anything. It's the sound, and just the fact that it was just so dark, and there were just like I remember it being like just small glimpses of light like coming off from the bar, or there'd be like just a couple of kind of old school kind of like, you know, like a club lights in there, you know, it's like parkans or whatever.
The spinny ball ones with the kind of like...
Yeah, I just remember it just being sort of just totally alien, but immediately getting really excited by it. And, you know, that first night was just, you know, as kind of rooms fill up and the atmosphere becomes far more intense and you start noticing people, you know, or... You know, you start recognizing music and all those kind of things start happening. It's just such a sensory, it's such an amazing moment, you know. And it must have just had such a impact on me then because...
Because you're still there. You haven't left.
Still bloody there, yeah. it was pretty powerful. And then after that, it was like, right, when's the next one? You know, they're going, oh, there's one on a Tuesday, which everyone goes to, which was the Camden Palace.
Now Coco, yeah.
Which it was the same DJs. They did a night there on a Tuesday. There was a live band that played as well, and it was like £2 to get in or something. So then you go there, and then you walk into Camden Palace for the first time, which, you know, you're just like, wow.
That is a big venue, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know when... You first went there, but
yeah, the first club I ever went to, like Coco, was GAY at the Astoria. So yeah, big like Coco.
Yeah,
15 with a whistle around my neck. So that's like a massive cavernous venue, like we're talking about.
Yeah, my first gig that I bought a ticket to was, I'd seen like bands before and stuff, but the first one that I bought a ticket to was for the Astoria. Actually, and I walked there from after school. I walked all the way from I went to a school called William Ellis, which is up in I don't know, it's like Hampstead sort of thing. It was state school around there, Parliament Hills, the Heath around there. So I walked from there all the way down to the Astoria, and I wanted to get a ticket for the Sub Pop tour, which was Nirvana headlining, Mudhoney and Tad. And I think this was in like, it might have been 90 or 91, maybe the tail end of 90. And it sold out by that point. And I'd saved my money up to go and get it. So I couldn't get a ticket for that. So I just looked at what other gigs were on there. It was on the wall, you know, quite innocently. Is there anything else that I know? And there was a band on there called Cud, who it's kind of band from Leeds. And I knew them. I had their music on a tape. Someone had recorded me some of their stuff. I knew a few of their songs. So I bought a ticket for there. And I remember going into the Astoria for the first time when I went to that gig. I went on my own as well. And walking into the Astoria, another incredible old like Victorian, like, you know, theatre.
You'd have to go up through this sort of mezzanine bar and then you'd get into the main room, right?
Yes.
Like up.
Yeah. A few of them were like that as well. Like the Scala's like that as well.
Scala, yes, exactly. Yeah. We're lucky to still have the Scala, actually. I mean, so many venues are just, you know, not here anymore. But yeah, the Scala's very similar to the Astoria.
Yeah.
I want to fast forward a few years, sorry, skipping around a bit here, but I want to talk about Trash Your Night, which ran on Monday. So first of all, it was at, it was in Soho.
Originally, yeah, originally in Plastic People, yeah, in 97.
Then, of course, it ended up at the End, legendary club. I pretty much started my club career at the End, discotheque on Thursday nights. I was doing the door.
Oh, yeah, of course, hold on. Yeah, Hold on, what years were you there then? Did we paper over?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a crossover. I want to say 2006, 2005, 2006.
Okay, yeah, so we would have, yeah, I mean, whenever I was in town, whatever night it was, I'd always end up at the end just to pop in to say hello to everyone, you know.
It was such a great venue.
It was an amazing venue. And you know what? It's, you know, when we talk about, you know, like how, like, you know, we like a lot of like the nightclubs that we went to and that in those early years and stuff, you know, were held in these old Victorian theatres. You know, it wasn't until going to like a really super modern nightclub like The End in the late 90s when I first started going there. And then somewhere like Fabric after, you know, where you kind of had these like bespoke spaces that were designed purely for a type of music and a type of energy almost, you know, and The End having its booth right there in the middle of the floor was something that, like, you know,
because there were two rooms, weren't there, and you wouldn't, even though they weren't connected, you wouldn't get really any bleed, would you?
Apparently there was when I DJ'd, because I was the loudest fuck around on there. Yeah, so yeah, but no, there were actually, it was actually really well designed in that way. Like, you know, the acoustics. Did you know that what The End was it was the tunnels for the post service? So those arches, the two arches in the main room, were kind of back and forth things for where horse-drawn carts would go underneath the ground.
Wow, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
In terms of music policy, I mean, I hate the word eclectic, but it wasn't really a music policy, was there?
Yeah, for Trash, I mean, the music policy really was. I'm completely aware of the concept of eclecticism, like in music in that way. But for me, it was always down to kind of what I like, and also the fact that I tend to like music from all over, and it's never, you know, I'm not someone who's, back then I was never into a particular genre on its own. And at the same time, that now fast forward, I'm not even into like particular, like the whole output of a particular artist, you know. So it's not even like, you know, I love bands, I love lots of certain artists, but I also believe that that with music, like, what somebody can make one incredible record and the rest of their output could be utter rubbish, you know. And it's finding that record, that moment, that's the brilliant thing, you know. And if that kind of sits alongside something else of a similar kind of brilliance, then, you know, you're kind of working with such potent, you know, pieces of art or whatever. I mean, just to kind of stick to one thing for me has never really been that exciting, because I like psychedelic music, for instance, but or disco music, and, you know, I don't like all disco music, and I certainly don't like all psychedelic music. So it's just about finding those little jewels, you know, all over the place.
So your policy was just kind of great records.
I hope so. That's what I aim for, and it's kind of how to put them together, really, was the like key for me. It was just about how you can how you kind of just put them together.
Yeah.
That was it.
I feel like you really broke careers in that room as well. I mean, I think I saw too many DJs play there.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. And Peaches, I definitely saw there.
Yeah. She played twice. So she played, she played at the beginning in like 2000, I think it was, or 2001.
Yeah, that was just before my time, yeah.
But then she played again for Dirt, which was like the sister club of Trash after that. And she played, I think that was like right in like 2008 when Trash finished in 2007. So,
right, I was in the DJ booth with her at that point.
Okay, so that would have been that one then, yeah.
Crawling around on the floor or something. And there was sort of like the Trash look as well, wasn't there? I feel like people would get dressed up for it.
Yeah, I think the only thing that we really wanted people to do was to kind of, you know, to put as much effort into it as they would like a Saturday night, even though it was on a Monday. And I think that only kind of came around when we really noticed people were doing that automatically, or we noticed that the people who came there, that was just their outlook anyway. That was how they would present themselves anyway, you know. So it was about encouraging people, really, rather than kind of like, you know, telling them as such. But the look was, it was so varied, you know.
Yeah, I guess like the music as well.
Yeah, it was. I think looking back, trash was really a big thing about, you know, just a lot of like freedom and just escapism, I think, you know.
I'm interested in how clubs evolve over time as well, from the artwork to the music policy to the crowd. So how do you feel like the night over its 10-year period sort of had a journey? I don't want to use the word brand, but how was Trash's journey?
If I was to say that it was all kind of planned and it was all deliberate, I'd be lying, really. Because it wasn't. It was really driven by so many natural elements. But I do believe in order for those elements to kind of come forward and to tell you what they are, then you do a lot of work in the background to get to that point, you know. I mean, you know, when Plastic People closed, you know, we wanted to find somewhere that was as good as Plastic People or just a little bit bigger, because we were selling Plastic People out every Monday. So when we found there was a venue, and this was the great thing about, you know, the West End back then in the late 90s, early noughties, there were nightclubs everywhere, you know, but and you didn't even know about half of them. So I went and looked at loads of different nightclubs to see what one felt right, you know, not just for us, but for our crowd as well. You know, a big part of it was to make sure that, you know, the venue would be accommodating for a crowd like ours, you know, that they would have a security that would be the right kind of security for our crowd, you know, because sometimes some nightclubs can deal with some pretty difficult, you know, clientele on the weekends, and that can sometimes transpose itself into the midweeks, you know, so you had to have quite sensitive.
Bane of my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Heavy-handed security, totally.
Absolutely. So, you know, it was a case of looking at loads of places, and then eventually you found a place called The Annex, which was on Dean Street, which isn't there anymore, unfortunately. And that was great, because that held like 350 people, and Plastic People held 180 people. So when we moved there, it was comfortable, and then all of a sudden that started selling out. So when that closed, my feeling at that point was, if I can't find somewhere that's not good enough to move to, there's no point kind of, you know, taking a step backwards or sideways, you know, let's really aim high. And that's when The End came in, you know, when it was a club that I used to go to myself on the weekends. On the weekends I was able to go and see, you know, DJs from a complete different musical space that people might have assumed that I was into, I suppose. And I just thought, well, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get, really. So I just reached out to them. I said, listen, I've got this night, you know, we've got really great crowds, you know, and I really love your space. And I was just wondering if you'd be interested in us talking about potentially moving there, you know, because we're about to lose our home. And they came straight back and said, we know all about Trash. The general manager had been a few times himself, said, yeah, come in and see me. I just went in and I just told them pretty much everything, like I've just told you about, you know, what kind of club it was and what we do. And they knew already, and they thought, well, yeah, why not?
Yeah. And you ended at 10
years. Yeah, exactly. Well, I love the word decade.
Yeah, draw a nice clean line underneath it.
Yeah, it's great if you can give people, when people say, like, how long did it last, rather than giving them a number, you can give them a word.
So, yeah, a decade. Yeah, exactly.
I like a decade. It's exactly 10 years to the week.
And I guess around that time there was Ghetto around the corner.
Yep.
Nag, nag, nag on Wednesdays at Ghetto. Yep. Oh my God.
Yeah, I was a resident on the Fridays there at the Cock.
Were you?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah, with Princess Julia and Tasty Tim.
Yeah.
Oh.
For Jim and Wayne, yeah. It's, I mean, I still love that venue. It's great fun.
There was Smash and Grab at Punk down on Soho Street, and Boombox.
Yeah.
Oh, the golden era.
The golden era. I mean, the thing is, I really like by the time Trash had finished, I mean, even before then, really, I mean, I was in nightclubs so much. I mean, at one point I was doing like 180 gigs a year or something like that, because I was doing every Friday, every Saturday and every Monday, you know, so it was 3 out of 7 days. And then on top of that, there'd be like the occasional Sunday or Thursday or whatever. So for a while I was kind of like, I was like nonstop. So I didn't really, like, if I had a night off, I'd probably be at home kind of making music or just getting myself back together again. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And then I guess around that time you had Mix Mag's DJ of the Year award, right?
Yeah, completely unexpected as well. But,
right. And was that a big surprise? I feel like you didn't play ball with that. You had the opportunity to sell out big time and didn't. I guess you remained true to your core and your tastes.
Well, I wasn't really that taking too much notice of kind of, I don't know what word you'd use, if it's like accolade or anything like that around me at the time, you know, like I just got on with what I was doing, you know, I had my head in so much stuff that, you know, like running the club and, you know, DJing every weekend and producing and whatever. And I never had like a manager. I've never had a manager. I only had an agent who I'm still with. I've been with for like 20 years, you know, and I really didn't go out I just wanted to do the best thing that I felt I could do. You know, it wasn't about competing with other DJs, because I think the whole thing of competing against DJs is just such an empty thing. It's like, how can you do that? It's, you know, like become like a politician or something, you know what I mean? So, I mean, my whole thing has been just to, you know, with Trash, it was like create the space that you want to exist, that you want to be in, you know, that you want to invite others in and they want to be in as well, and make that as great as it can be. And then, you know, I just try to take that same mindset into what I do, you know, if it's whatever it is, it's kind of to compete against other people for something that is fundamentally an extension of yourself in the truest sense possible, just to me just seems completely like pointless, you know.
A waste of time, 100%, yeah. And then you had a residency at Bugged Out, didn't you, for a long time?
I think I still do, actually. I think you're right, because I kind of like ended up being a resident for them around like 2002 or something. And that kind of carried on. And I suppose I was resident in London when it was at the end, you know, when they had Bugged Out at the end, and then they kind of moved venue. So I was always on the lineups there. And I still am kind of regular on their lineups.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Do you enjoy the consistency of a residency? Does that give you space to kind of develop anything in your sound? Playing in the same room week by week.
Yeah.
Was it weekly or monthly?
The Bugged Out one was monthly, I think. And it was in room two at the end. That was in room two. And the really good thing about that was, you know, you could use that set, those 2 hours, to kind of just test a lot of new records out, you know, rather than be like a headliner where, you know, you could kind of take a few risks or be a bit more playful with it. You didn't have to sort of feel that, you know, that they kind of like wanted anything from you other than just...
your great music selection.
Hopefully, yeah, great, yeah, hopefully.
And you're quite big in the indie queer scene as well, I believe. Would you say that? Like... you've played Homo Block. And...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to DJ. I mean, like, the great thing about Trash was that it really was open to everybody in that way. And it wanted everyone to feel welcome, regardless of, you know, gender or sexuality or anything like that. And I was then, I was also resident at Popstars at the Scala.
Yeah. Great night. Friday nights at the Scala.
And then, yeah, I mean, and also at the Cock, and places like, Homo Electric, like, you know, playing regularly for them up there. Also in Amsterdam, like the Rao parties over there, where we played last time my senior, it was like last year, wasn't it, at the festival, Milkshake?
Milkshake, oh, so good. Favourite. We were in the booth together, yeah.
We were, okay. Yeah, okay, great, yeah. Yeah, it was good fun, that one, actually. It got a little bit out of hand near the end as well.
Yeah, Honey Dijon was on the lineup. Blessed Madonna.
Felix Housecat.
Felix the Housecat was, yes.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I mean, I've always kind of, I've always been, you know, involved with those parties, the queer parties, and they're just, you know, they're so much fun, and musically as well, it kind of, I feel that I can tap into, you know, a part of me that can kind of play into the spirit of it a bit more, you know what I mean? So it's, I really enjoy them.
And which of your DJ sets sort of over the years has stood out as being really special? Like when have you come out the DJ booth thinking, oh, I've got the best job in the world?
The one that really sticks with me that really kind of that had a big impact on me was because it was basically, I think it was 2006, and it was Benny Kassim Festival, and it was on a Thursday, and I flew in there. I got taken like to the main stage. The Scissor Sisters were playing on the main stage, and obviously we're friends and stuff, so I was just watching them play, and I said to the artist liaison, oh, should I get to my stage, because I think I'm on in like half an hour or something like that. And they looked at me and they were just like, what do you mean? And I was like, you know, surely I'm in some kind of tent somewhere, you know, over another part of the festival. And they're just like, no, you're on next here. And I was like, I completely didn't realize I was playing the main stage at Benny Kassim, like after the headliner. And I hadn't kind of prepared myself to like play to like tens of thousands of people, you know, after like their live show, which, you know, was like, it's like super, like it's like a musical on ice, you know. You know, lots of,
yeah, you have to hold on to that crowd, right?
Yeah,
you've got to keep them there.
Exactly. And they're going to take like the Sisters off, and then they're going to wheel on like a table with like two CD players on, and I'm going to like shuffle over to it. So yeah, and I was just like, I just remember, like, you know, the gig ended and they like cleared the stage as fast as possible, pushed the table on there, and I just kind of like, I don't really get nervous before DJing, but I was kind of slightly like annoyed with myself that I wasn't aware that I was playing something of that kind of prestige, I suppose, you know, such a large audience. But it was absolutely fine. I kind of just started the first track. I think I played, the first track was like Standing the Way of Control, like the original version of it by The Gossip.
Yeah, great record.
And you know, tens of thousands of people just swarmed back to the stage. It was incredible. Like, I don't know how many people were there. It was like, I mean, it was the main stage, but it seems, so it was like thousands and thousands of people. And just completely like winged it, you know? And I remember seeing like, you know, Jason from Sisters at the front.
He loves a party, doesn't he?
He does love a party. It just felt really, it was just one of those things where you just got to trust in yourself sometimes. You know, you might end up in a situation that you weren't expecting, but it'll be all right. And I think even like, you know, this year someone said to me, like, I saw you at Benny Kassim in 2006, and it was like one of the best, you know.
One of those shows that everyone always talks about.
Yeah, and you can't really plan that at all. You can't really plan to do that, I don't think. Not as a DJ, because, you know, as DJs, you know, we try to be as kind of reactive as you can be to what's in front of you, who's in front of you, and kind of to measure that and to kind of read it and to do the best thing that you feel you can do. So to kind of have an assumption as to what it's going to be like beforehand and then reach that is always kind of like, is always a bit of a illusion to me, really.
You're setting yourself up for some kind of like, oh, that was that then. I guess the surprise element of that show is what made it amazing.
You know what? I think,
and you were like, what?
I think you're right. I think that's what it was. I was completely unaware of it, and then you just end up in there, in the middle of it, and then you kind of come through it, and you come through it feeling kind of content and happy with it. I think it's really important.
Do you have a favorite venue to play anywhere in the world?
No, it's always about people for me. there are venues which are great, you know, there's great venues which are great sound systems and stuff, but really it's, you know, I've played in some dives and stuff, but it's, you know, the crowd has been so great, it completely overrides that. Like, I really believe in it's like people over those places.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about that, the people and the sense of community and that raw energy in a nightclub that you can't really compare with anything else.
Absolutely. But it's also down to, you know, I've played in some like kind of really terrible, through some terrible sound systems in some shoddy rooms with, you know, no lights or anything like that. And it's just been amazing experiences, really. So it's just about creating that energy, I feel.
Yeah. Did you do some streams in lockdown?
I did. And I've never done it before. You know, I've never done that kind of thing before, because for me, it's always been about just real clubs and moments and people and stuff. But obviously when you're kind of faced with, as we were all faced with, you know, the situation we were in, I did something with ID, and we did a big benefit for Homo Block, did a big benefit, a charity fundraiser, and I played a set on there, and I think that's it.
Yeah, I did quite a few as well, and it takes a minute to get used to that, doesn't it? That sort of lack of exchange of energy that you would get in real life, and DJing to a phone. It's like different.
It is different, and you do really kind of you piece, you know, your music together in a different way, I think, you know. Like I say, cause it's not reactive at all to what's on there, because it's just hard to measure any of it, you know. You just gotta just hope that what you're gonna play is something that is gonna sound interesting to somebody listening to down the other end of a phone, really.
Yeah, I did a few on Instagram Live as well, and you can see the comments coming up and stuff, and it's a bit distracting and yeah, makes you a bit nervous. And I was like, sweating my makeup off.
I did that, and my friend later told me that, like, he goes, oh, everyone was in there, you know. So it was a bit like the green room of like a nightclub, and they were like, so-and-so was in there, so-and-so was chatting to so-and-so, whatever. So it was a little bit kind of a bit like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, in this instance, you know, when we don't have much to kind of play with, I suppose, right now, you know, it's something, you know.
Yeah. And also, while we've been in lockdown, have you been focusing on making music? And obviously you've got the label.
Yeah, no music, really, not much, because I didn't really care for making music, really, to be honest with you. It was, you know, there has been so much news that's very saddening, you know, that you don't really, that part of you just isn't there, you know, to go and be playful and to kind of, yeah, I just couldn't draw in that area, you know. I was very happy just kind of just taking care of what I needed to take care of on a purely pragmatic level. Like, I know at the beginning of lockdown, so many people were saying, oh, you know, they're going to write their book, they're going to make their album, they're going to do all the things that they, but I, you know, For me, I just couldn't really kind of get my head around that. I just wanted to kind of do whatever that needed to be done in front of me, really.
I once saw you play for a really long time. I think it was at Village Underground.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it might have been, yeah.
And you played for a really, really long time, right?
Village Underground, I think it was like 6 or 7 hours, maybe.
Yeah, where the hell is that stamina coming from? That's very impressive.
I used to do fire, and I used to do like 9, 10, 11. I thought it was the most I did, 10 or 11, maybe, hours.
Did you just drink loads of Red Bull?
No. I had just a banana and one vodka and orange before I started.
Wow, that's the secret. That's the the banana vodka diet.
That's it. But I really enjoy it. I really enjoy playing for a long time, because, again, it's like, you know, what we were saying earlier about joining the dots between loads of different kind of things. I mean, if you're playing that long, you need to kind of go to different places, and you need to, without, you know, falling into the cliche of like going on a journey, you know.
Telling a story,
yeah. But you kind of, if you have a vague map in your head, then I think you need to give yourself a little bit of structure, but also allow a lot of room for, you know, we talked about earlier about the spontaneity, reading situations, and also not being a bore as well, you know, like kind of knowing when the right point is to kind of like flip everything on its head or
do a left turn.
Yeah.
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 Have you ever found love on the dance floor?
I have certainly had huge emotional moments on dance floors. Yeah. But not attached to anybody else. not that I love myself or anything like that, but I think definitely, you know, hearing music that's just in certain, you know, like how people can, what some DJs can do is they can like put a series of records together which can like transcend the individual parts of those records. You know, it just kind of leads you into somewhere and it kind of does something to you. You know, it stirs something in you and it takes you somewhere and it draws something quite incredible out of you. And I suppose as a DJ, it's to have felt that, you want to also offer that as well in some way. Not all the time. You can't do it all the time and nor should you do it all the time. But especially if you're, you know, playing long sets or particular places or at a particular point in time or something, you know, sometimes if you're able to kind of achieve that kind of thing through music, then it's great.
Do you feel that when you're playing sometimes as well, almost like you're a clubber on the dance floor? Or do you feel like you're more the person in control telling the story?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think I can feel it if there's any chance of it something being felt out there. I think I can feel it coming on a little bit myself.
That heart, tummy thing.
Yeah, a little bit. Like I've definitely kind of, there's a few records that that you know, if you're going to play that, they're going to take, and they tend to sometimes not be potential, you know, clubby records in themselves. You know, they tend to be records outside of the club. Or, you know, it happens a lot with, you know, more kind of song-based genres potentially, like, you know, disco as well, you know.
Yeah, the emotion in the strings and the lyrics. And
yeah, and those records are designed for that, you know.
Totally. Disco's great for that.
Yeah.
I can laugh, I can cry to a disco record.
Yeah, exactly.
If you could visit a club from the past, what would that be?
Oh, God, Lord. I would probably, and quite obviously, probably say Studio 54, just because, you know, there's just been so much written about it, and, you know, films and legendary tales, and
it's so romanticized, isn't it, as well? We know, yeah, all the black and white pictures. We know how it was only great for 18 months or so, and that magical moment in time.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be my first choice as well, of course. Such a cliche. Right, I'm going to throw a couple of quick fire questions at you.
Okay.
Okay, you're throwing a party.
Yep.
Who are you inviting? They could be living or dead. Let's say three names.
Three names. Bob Mortimer. James Brown. Also, just for the character. And Richard Pryor. Yeah, I think that'd be a really interesting
mix. Yeah.
Really interesting mix.
Yes. And who's the DJ? Who's playing the records?
The DJ, I think I'd need to share this with somebody who I know. So I'd invite Rory Phillips from Trash.
Okay, yep.
He knows his way around DJing a dinner party. Was it a dinner party? I wasn't too sure because I only left
for it is
three
now.
People is enough for dinner, I suppose.
I didn't realise we were serving food, but we absolutely can in this venue. We have a food and beverage licence.
You know, one thing I have done in lockdown was I really got into making cakes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Banana bread and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I've only really got into carrots and lemon and lime cake. So I'm big on citrus. So yeah, I really enjoy it.
All right, can't wait to taste that. Is that what you're promoting at the moment?
Yeah, this is it.
Catch my new cake coming out soon.
New 12-inch.
Yeah, my new. All right. And on that note, Errol Elkin, this is your life of the party. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
It was really nice to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much.
This has been Life of the Party with me, Jody Harsh. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you haven't subscribed just yet, please do. There's a new episode every week. Right, see you at the next party.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.